It is Friday, February the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up in South Africa, one president is out, a new one takes office, and will be new elections ahead.
This new, united, optimistic ANC is probably not likely to do that.
The Chinese New Year renewed promise to end poverty.
That is still palpable poverty, and despite guarantees in the Constitution that all Chinese would have 15 years free education, the situation in accessible hilly regions is different.
President Trump, another deadly U.S. shooting, plus prospects for the next U.S. election. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Less than 24 hours after Jacob Zuma's late-night resignation, South Africa does have a new president. Cyril Ramaphosa is a successful businessman and stalwart member of the African National Congress. He also was instrumental in the push to force Zuma to resign. My colleague Sarah Williams speaks with VOA's Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell about all of this.
So it was a real festive, kind of lighthearted occasion in Parliament. We haven't seen that in a while, especially not during the very, very combative Zuma years. So it was there was a lot of pomp, and Cyril Ramaphosa was the only nominee. He was nominated by his party, the African National Congress, and it did not need to go to a vote because he was the only nominee. It was seconded, and the Chief Justice said, okay, fine, it's going to be Cyril Ramaphosa. He's the new president-elect of South Africa. He was put on notice a little bit by opposition parties who said, we will hold you accountable, we will continue to challenge you. But overall, the mood was really hopeful, I would say, after 9 years of such despair, I think, among the opposition and so much contention and tension in the ANC and in Parliament.
Well, Ramaphosa's, this happened to Ramaphosa after Jacob Zuma resigned. Now, it seemed like that happened sort of suddenly, because it seemed like yesterday, at least, that he didn't want to resign.
Right. So when Zuma addressed the nation last night, and you recall it was about 10:30 at night, so 90 minutes before his putative midnight deadline, he explained that, and he's correct about this, that the ANC never gave him a particular accounting of what they believe he did wrong. They just said, you need to go. And he said that as a loyal member of the ANC, he felt it was important to honor the recall. He also said, for the record, I guess to make the point, that he said he was not afraid or embarrassed by a no-confidence vote, and he respected the parliament. But he also did avoid that fate by stepping out of that and just resigning.
I guess you hinted at this a bit earlier. The opposition Economic Freedom Fighters Party staged a walkout before the vote regarding Mr. Ramaphosa, and I believe they have called for early elections. Is that likely at all?
They are not. The Economic Freedom Fighters are not the only party that have called for early elections, and they say they're referring to Article 50 of the Constitution that says when there is a resignation, there should be a dissolution of parliament and snap elections. However, let's remember that parliament is 62% controlled by the African National Congress. So if they approach parliament, if the opposition approaches parliament, they will need members of the ANC to cross the aisle and vote with them on that. And this new, united, optimistic ANC is probably not likely to do that.
Anita, I understand that Zuma's son is in legal trouble of his own.
Yes, one of Zuma's sons. Remember, Zuma has more than 20 known children. One of Zuma's older sons, he's in his early 30s, Dudu Zane, is currently being sought by the police in connection with a massive, large-scale corruption case. It also involves that family that has seen so many headlines in South Africa, the Gupta family. This is the Indian family that is accused of manipulating Jacob Zuma and infiltrating the South African government and exercising undue influence. And Dudu Zane Zuma was the head of their computer organization, Sahara Computers. And so he is also being sought by police as we speak, along with one of the Gupta brothers, Ajay, who's also on the run. The other brothers in custody, Atul, he was seized after he attempted to leave South Africa on a private jet, and the pilot refused to take off.
Anita Powell is our correspondent in Southern Africa. She was speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
Today is the start of the Chinese Lunar New Year, or Spring Festival. It's a time to honor deities and ancestors. It is also a great family time. Lots of fireworks, dancing, homes are decorated in the color of red, which symbolizes a good fortune. The Chinese zodiac moves in a 12-year cycle, and this is the year of the dog. People born during the year are described as independent, sincere, communicative, and loyal. Meantime, President Xi Jinping is taking the opportunity to emphasize three main policy goals: growth, he says, stability, and reform. During a recent trip to the southwest province of Sichuan, Mr. Xi vowed to end poverty after pledging in 2015 to lift tens of millions of people out of poverty by the year 2020. Willie Lam is an adjunct professor at the Center for China Studies at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He tells my colleague Victor Beatty the new year is a time for reflection by the Communist Party as well on their leadership and on the political and social situation, specifically whether the rich-poor gap is narrowing.
So far, despite pledges by President Xi Jinping that all Chinese would be lifted out of the poverty line within just 4 or 5 years, that is massive social inequality. The Gini coefficient officially at 0.73 is actually, according to Chinese sociologists, close to 0.6, which is a highly combustible level, which could prompt massive social unrest.
President Xi, as you indicated, was in the southwest of the country in Sichuan province. He said, in the past, we did have ghosts, the ghosts of ignorance, backwardness, and poverty. It almost sounds like Lyndon Johnson's Great Society of the 1960s here in the U.S.
Indeed. When Xi Jinping first came to power, he raised the banner of the Chinese dream. And more recently, he mentioned the two important goals, particularly the watershed year 2049, the 100th birthday of the establishment of the People's Republic, when China will have become a superpower, will have closed the gap with the U.S. However, it is important to note that while everywhere we see signs of prosperity along the so-called Gold Coast, stretching from Beijing down to Shenzhen, close to Hong Kong, in the inner and particularly the western provinces, there is still palpable poverty. And despite guarantees in the constitution that all Chinese would have 15 years free education, the situation in accessible hilly regions is different. There are many children, particularly those who are left at home because their parents are working in the cities, who only have education up to 8-9 years, particularly for girls who are traditionally denied opportunities. Above all, Xi Jinping has failed to honor his pledge to abolish the so-called household residence system, which is a kind of a Chinese-style apartheid, if you will, whereby those Chinese who are born in the hilly regions, in the poor provinces, cannot legally move to live in the big cities. So that is still massive inequality in China. And I think as the country becomes more visible internationally, as China's GDP is about to overtake that of the U.S., and also as Chinese as a whole are more educated than generations before, I think people will be asking questions about the political system and in particular possibilities for political participation, whereby the people have a chance to voice their views about these massive inequalities in the country.
Willie Lam describes Xi Jinping as a closet Maoist who believes in the Leninist system of concentration of power at the top. He warned the failure of the political system to keep pace with the demands of the growing middle class in China, including a say in their future, could generate tension between the country's aristocracy and the still poor peasants and migrant workers, leading to social unrest. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Authorities in the U.S. state of Florida have charged a 19-year-old man with 17 counts of premeditated murder, all of that in connection with the latest mass shooting at an American school. VOA's Jeff Custer reporting now from the VOA Washington News Center.
Former student Nicholas Cruz, who had been expelled for disciplinary problems, is accused of killing 17 people and wounding 16 others at Florida's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Wednesday. Police arrested Cruz off school grounds without a struggle, and he was taken to the Broward County Jail. Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel said Cruz was armed with an AR-15 rifle and multiple magazines.
Nicholas, I think we spell his name N-I-K-O-L-A-S, Cruz, was the killer. He is in custody, and we've already began to dissect his websites and the things that social media that he was on, and some of the things that have come to mind are very, very disturbing.
Early Thursday, U.S. President Donald Trump weighed in on the shooting, saying the shooter had given many signs that he was dangerous and urged people to report such behavior. Florida Governor Rick Scott met with victims and their families.
You know, I already talked to my daughter today and said, I'm sure every parent's doing the same thing. Is my child going to a safe school? Is it safe where they're going? And I know our law enforcement is going to continue to do everything they can to keep every child in our state safe. And we're going to continue to figure out how we learn from this to hopefully try to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Florida's Attorney General said the state will pay for the funerals and counseling for the families. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
And as Jeff just mentioned, President Trump is addressing the nation. He did so on Thursday about that mass shooting in Florida.
Our entire nation, with one heavy heart, is praying for the victims and their families. To every parent, teacher, and child who is hurting so badly, we are here for you, whatever you need, whatever we can do to ease your pain. We are all joined together as one American family, and your suffering is our burden also. No child, no teacher should ever be in danger in an American school. No parent should ever have to fear for their sons and daughters when they kiss them goodbye in the morning. Each person who was stolen from us yesterday had a full life ahead of them. A life filled with wondrous beauty and unlimited potential and promise. Each one had dreams to pursue, love to give, and talents to share with the world. And each one had a family to whom they meant everything in the world.
President Trump, speaking at the White House, also announced that he would be visiting Parkland, Florida, where the shooting took place. . 2018 is a congressional election year here in the United States, with all 435 seats in the House of Representatives at stake and 34 of the 100 Senate seats. Midterm elections historically have not been kind to sitting presidents. On average, the president's party loses 30 House seats and about 2 Senate seats. And as VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone reports, President Trump is urging his supporters to defy history, much as they did when he won the White House in 2016.
Looking ahead to the November congressional elections, President Donald Trump is worried his supporters may not be motivated to vote.
They sort of take it for granted. They sit back, and then they get clobbered because the other people are desperate. And they get out, and they have more energy. But I think because of what we've done, because of the tremendous success we've had, I have a feeling that we're going to do incredibly well in 18. And I have to say this. History is not on our side.
The president's party usually loses seats in midterm elections, and this year should repeat the pattern, says Jim Kessler of the research organization Third Way.
But, you know, you have a very unpopular president, and if Democrats take a broad path, they should win lots and lots of seats.
Trump hopes to rebound from a year of historically low poll ratings by focusing on the strong economy and his tax bill. That should help Republicans, says Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
My view of this, if we can't sell this to the American people, we ought to go into another line of work.
Democrats are encouraged after statewide victories last year in Alabama and Virginia, where they made Trump a central issue. Party activist and billionaire Tom Steyer has financed an ad campaign calling for Trump's impeachment.
My fight is in removing Donald Trump from office and from power. And that starts with taking the House back in 2018.
Republicans hope the economy will boost Trump's poll ratings over time, says Michael Barone.
And he's taking an optimistic tone. He's following up on the indications that the economy is growing at a pretty healthy rate.
But many voters, especially the president's critics, are likely to see the midterms as a referendum on Trump, according to analyst John Hudak.
The president will be the defining factor in the 2018 election. There are many out there who argue that Democrats won't be successful in 2018 because they don't have this broad, well-defined agenda. But in reality, out parties don't need to.
Democrats need to gain 24 House seats and 2 seats in the Senate to win a majority in both chambers. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
This week, many celebrated Valentine's Day. That's a romantic holiday where people give cards, flowers, gifts to one another. In fact, candy is very popular. And one of the best places to find an unusual assortment is at the True Treats Historic Candy Store. That's in the U.S. town of Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. That shop sells an abundance of sweets that were popular at different periods in our history. We get more now from VOA's Deborah Block.
It's a love fest for sweets at True Treats in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, the only historic candy store in the United States. The shop opened 8 years ago and features everything from ancient Greek chewing gum to 20th century classics. Owner Susan Benjamin offers customers interesting tidbits about the 400 products on display.
Violet, rose.
The first commercial candy appeared in 1806. Customers enjoy reading historical backgrounds on the candy labels.
It's fun to see the progression through the years of the different kinds of chocolates and candy.
Surprisingly, sweets were first used for health problems, says Benjamin.
Sugar were used as a medicine, and the Turkish delight was made for sore throat somewhere around the year 900, and it became very popular worldwide.
People also chewed on bark, branches, and roots.
In the mid-1800s, when kids would go and buy a root of licorice plant, and they would chew it and get that delicious licorice flavor.
A popular novelty item at True Treats is a bag of roasted bugs, with crickets and mealyworms, once considered a sweet snack. In the 1950s, Ant wafers made their debut.
The crickets to me taste a little bit like sesame. And I've had ants, which some of them are a little bit bitter. They're almost tart, like a lemon.
Small, round fruit and nut chocolate candies were popular from the 1920s to 1950s with people who played card games.
They made little candies that people could pick up with their fingers in one hand and then hold the cards in the other.
Some customers find candy that brings back memories.
Probably seen this, 18 years ago or something, but now it's here. I can have it.
Others are too young to have grown up with any of the candy in the store.
I came here a lot as a kid, so it's a kind of lot of nostalgia, which is weird because it's in such an unfamiliar setting, yet I have so many fond memories.
For people who want to know more about candy's guilty pleasures, Benjamin has written a book called Sweet as Sin about the intriguing evolution of these confectionery treats. Deborah Block, VOA News, Harper's Ferry, West Virginia.
Yeah, I think Debbie's convinced me I've got to have some candied bugs as soon as possible. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2012, NASA astronomers predicted that our Milky Way galaxy will collide with its neighboring Andromeda galaxy in about 4 billion years. Scientists said that when this galactic collision takes place, Andromeda, believed to be 2 to 3 times the size of the Milky Way, will completely engulf our own galaxy. Now, an international team of researchers finds that both galaxies are about the same size. Past studies have determined the Milky Way has a mass of 750 billion times that of our sun. Using a new scientific technique, the researchers have determined that the Andromeda galaxy is about 800 billion times more massive than our sun. Researchers say that in light of their new findings that both galaxies are nearly equal in mass, new simulations are needed to determine what will happen when Andromeda and the Milky Way do collide. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. A very popular singing group is about to reunite and go on tour. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and VOA's Jim Stevenson get ready for old fans and a new generation to spice up their live music enjoyment.
Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Don't tell me what you want.
They say what goes around comes around, and in this case, that would be a positive thing.
Yes.
Get ready to turn back the clock 20 years because the Spice Girls are one step closer to reuniting and touring. Now, TMZ reports that the five original members, there's Mel B, Scary Spice, mm-hmm. Mel C, Sporty Spice, Emma Bunton, Baby Spice, Jerry Horner, Ginger Spice, and Victoria Beckham, Posh Spice, have all signed off on plans for a reunion tour. TMZ says that last Friday, Mel B signed the contract, which calls for a full tour. The others followed suit. Now, the contract contained the number of dates and the compensation, neither of which have yet been revealed. The gigs will allegedly only take place in the United Kingdom and the United States, and there aren't going to be that many of them. The women will reportedly pocket $14 million apiece from the tour.
That's incentive to get back together.
It sure is, isn't it? The whole thing was masterminded by their former manager, Simon Fuller, who, of course, was also the mastermind behind American Idol. Now, Jerry left the Spice Girls 20 years ago, in 1998, at the very height of their popularity. They haven't released a studio album in 18 years. They toured together in 2007, and they last performed together at the closing ceremony of the 2012 London Olympics. They were supposed to go out on a 20th anniversary tour in 2016, but that was scuttled due to Mel C and Victoria refusing to participate. This time, everybody's on board, and right now it's looking like a done deal.
And presumably, there's a lot more chances for distribution this time around because 20 years ago, things were a little bit different.
Absolutely.
Yeah, now you can put out all the videos and all the streaming stuff and all the
pay-per-view, you name it. From what we understand, there will not be any new music. There will not be an album coming out of this. It's going to be a greatest hits tour. But I think for the legion of Spice Girl fans worldwide, that'll probably be enough.
Something tells me there might be a live compilation out of this thing.
Oh, you think so? You're an astute man, Jim Stevenson.
Well, you're always on top of things because each and every week you give us the top 20 countdown. Maybe the Spice Girls will get back in. Who knows? Check
out Ray.
Anything's
possible.
Anything's possible. And VOA1 is the place to find it. Also on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
And all those athletes in South Korea spicing it up at the Olympics, you can find out all about it at voanews.com. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdelrahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday, everyone.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the identification or location of Muhammad al-Jolani, leader of the al-Nusra Front, or ANF, terrorist group. This is the first Rewards for Justice reward offer for a leader of al-Nusra Front, the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda. In 2013, al-Jolani pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, after he had a public falling out with ISIS. In 2016, in a video posted online, al-Jolani praised al-Qaeda and al-Zawahiri and claimed the ANF was changing its name to Jabhat Fath al-Sham. Under al-Jolani's leadership, ANF has carried out multiple terrorist attacks throughout Syria, often targeting civilians. In April 2015, ANF reportedly kidnapped and later released approximately 300 Kurdish civilians from a checkpoint in Syria. In June 2015, ANF claimed responsibility for the massacre of 20 residents in a Druze village in Idlib province, Syria. In January 2017, ANF merged with several other hardline opposition groups to form Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. ANF remains al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, and Jolani remains the leader of ANF, which is at the core of HTS. In 2014, ANF was designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. The same year, the UN added ANF to its sanctions list. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. For more information about al-Jolani, go to www.rewardsforjustice.net. We encourage anyone with information about al-Jolani to contact the Rewards for Justice office via email on the website, info@rewardsforjustice.net, by phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or by mail, Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
From Washington,